Our 11 tradition, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need to always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. In our anonymity statement, our anonymity, like our sobriety, is a treasured possession. We ask the help of our guests, especially those representing the press and broadcasting media, in protecting the anonymity of all of alcoholics present or mentioned here today. We hope you hear something at this meeting which you can take away with you to use. We respectfully request, however, that you eliminate any mention of last names in reference to members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Brant from Area 34 and his home group's Elegant Gratitude meeting is going to read the preamble.
Hello, my name is Brant and I'm an alcoholic. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contribution. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety.
You're welcome. Greg from the Manistee County Group, Area 34, is going to read how it works.
I'm Greg, I'm alcoholic.
Hi,
everyone. How it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrong. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order. I can't go through with this." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought.
And Ruth from the Grace Gratitude Group in Grand Rapids, Area 34, will read the promises.
Hi, my name is Ruth. I'm an alcoholic. The promises. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and the outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. And we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. There are sometimes being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, and they will always materialize if we work for them. Alcoholics Anonymous, Big Book, page 83 and 84.
Dave from the Vicksburg Group in Western Michigan, Area 34, is going to read the traditions.
Morning, everybody. I'm Dave, and I'm a drunk.
Hi, Dave.
I'm gratefully non-practicing and sober for another day, and 100% grateful to be an alcoholic. These are the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and film. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Before I introduce the speaker, somebody left their glasses back there by the water table when you got them up here. I don't know a whole bunch about the speaker. I just met her this morning, so I really haven't got a lot to tell you to introduce her. It's just Mildred Ed.
My name is Mildred Frank, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I'm really glad to be here, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart. This is the best conference I've ever been at. Isn't that the truth? And do I mean that the others haven't been great? Not at all. It's like saying, which is the best step? Well, I guess it's the one you're working on. And I guess which conference is the best? It's the one that you're attending. However, I must say that I feel that the speakers have been just outstanding. Either they're growing, or I am, or maybe both. But I just enjoyed Tom so much and our beauties yesterday and Johnny, and I must say, I'm the kid on the block. You know, sometimes I'm the oldest in sobriety at a conference, and here, you know, you've got somebody with 47 years and with 41 and 38, and I'm only a kid at 24 years of sobriety, so... But I'll tell you, those years have been precious years. They are one more proof, I guess. You know, that's the problem with being the Sunday morning speaker. By the way, the spiritual speaker, is that the truth? Some people who know where I've been would kind of take exception to that. They'd certainly be surprised to hear me listed as that. You know, the problem with being the last speaker is that it's all been said. And said better than you can probably say it. And, you know, so the inclination is to say, I have nothing to say, but that's not true. Because I am another proof that self-will does not work. I am one more proof that a person who has her own plans is bound to live in pain until that self-directed life is changed to a God-directed life, or at least in the process of having that happen. And that certainly is what my talk is about today, the thing that I have to share. I'd like to thank the committee for having me, even though they put Mildred P. on my cup. If I show my sponsor, she's going to be wondering what I've been doing on these weekends away. Anyway, you know, I've really enjoyed the spirit of friendliness here there's a special spirit here, and I certainly have enjoyed it. So my thanks to Tom and to Johnny and to Arbutus, and here we go. I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. And you know, if you're new, you're probably saying, she should be locked up. Why would anybody be grateful to be an alcoholic? Well, if you think I should be locked up, let me assure you I have been locked up many times. In one psychiatric ward, insane asylum, or mental institution in my country, which is Canada, and in yours. Sometimes I was locked up because I wanted to be locked up. Sometimes they locked me up because other folks wanted me to be locked up. Sometimes it was for periods of 5 days, and sometimes it was for periods of 5 months. I woke up in those places. Sometimes my door had no knob on the side, and it was not an architectural deficiency. On two occasions, I woke up tied to the bed, and trust me, it was not for fun and frolic. See, I left the convent on time to find out what that was all about. While I was in those places, they diagnosed me. They said that I was a schizophrenic. Well, I thought everybody heard voices. They said that I was paranoid schizoid and schizoid paranoid. They said that I was manic depressive manic. and manic depressive depressed. They said that I had an organic personality disorder, and they said I had a chronic personality disorder. And you can bet your bottom dollar I was glad nobody said, "We think you're an alcoholic." I didn't care. If you wanted to call me by any of those names, I did not care. As long as you did not find out or you did not confront the fact that I was drinking 52 ounces of hard liquor a day, or that I was doing the kinds of things that I was doing. They gave me shock treatment. See, I've also had hundreds of hours of therapy. You know, I'm not going to get into outside issues, but I can tell you this, that I left all that therapy in as much trouble with myself as I had ever been, and absolutely no insight into what was wrong with me. And then they decided shock treatments would be a good thing. And I can remember sitting in that insane asylum, as it was called, waiting to be called in, because I knew that I was going in and I knew what was going to happen when I got in there. And I was so terrified, you know, the sweat would be pouring down my face. But in here I'd be thinking, thank God they didn't ask me if I drink too much. Now, you got to be a dyed-in-the-wool alcoholic to think like that. One time they gave me 25 shock treatments, another time they gave me 13, and each time I left there, I can tell you, I knew somebody had lit up my life. But it wasn't about the kind of change that was necessary for me to live happily on this earth. And then I met a psychiatrist who said, "We think you're alcoholic," and that was very good news indeed. I thought he deserved a reward, so I married him. I never want to forget what this disease is about, and the fact that I live at a time when Alcoholics Anonymous is available if I want to pick up those tools. I have my grandparents and my parents were Americans, and my grandfather died in the early 1900s in a pool of his own blood as an alcoholic, because there was no Alcoholics Anonymous. I have an uncle who was shot. I had another who was drowned, and all because of alcoholism. And then I have a brother, when I was a little girl, he was practicing. He's now 47 years sober. And I saw him when I was a little girl doing the kinds of things that he was doing. And strangely enough, in 1951, I had gone to the convent already, and when I came home that summer, he and the mayor of our town took me aside, and they played records of a man named Father John Doe. Many of you know, he wrote the Golden Books and all that kind of stuff. They didn't play that for me because they thought at that time I had a problem. My brother had been the outcast of the family, and now my father was saying, "He's gone to this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know, he's changed." And in 1951, nobody knew much about this, certainly not on the prairies. I'm not just sure what year they brought Alcoholics Anonymous to Saskatchewan, but I know that my father didn't understand. He was just grateful that my brother said he used to be a bum. And now he works all day on the farm, and he cleans up, and he goes and does 12-step work, because in those days there were no treatment centers. And the hospital in Humboldt, Saskatchewan, had a nun like Sister Ignatia who gave the AAs a room, and if they would do 24-hour babysitting, they could bring their sick alcoholics there, and my brother would go and take his turn all night, and then he would come home and get into his work clothes and go work on the farm. And my father just threw up his hands and said, "I don't know, but he said it's good." And so when I heard about AA, when this psychiatrist said you should go to Alcoholics Anonymous, of course I was thrilled. But did I know what was involved? No, all I knew was that good things happen. I didn't know that you had to do something. Well, you know, I don't ever want to forget the state of hopelessness that I was in when I came here. You know, the book talks about a state of pitiful demoralization, and that was me. I was reminded of this one day. I'm a high school teacher by profession, and About 15 years ago, I was invited to come to Bermuda to speak, and I was also invited to do some other stuff when I was there, so I needed 2 days off. And my school board was always very generous in those days in giving me time with pay, and we had a new principal, and I was really concerned about going in to tell him that I needed this time off. And I even thought about telling him a lie. I was kind of afraid of him because he was, well, somebody I thought I needed to fear. He belonged to an evangelical church. He was a minister in that church, and he had come from a military background. And I didn't think that he would be very kindly disposed to somebody saying, I'm going to an AA function, I need 2 days off. And I thought, well, while I'm at it, I might as well give him the whole shot because he'll be looking at my record and he'll know I'm also an ex-nun. So I went to his office sweating. And I asked for the time and told him what it was about, and he said, oh, that's not a problem. Then he said, have you got that big book you folks read? And I said, certainly I have. And he said, could you bring me a copy? I said, certainly. So I got him a copy. And I brought it to his office the next day. And about 2 days later, he called me on the intercom. And I thought, oh my goodness, I wonder what this is about. And I got to the office door, and he got up from behind his desk. And he held out this book with some degree of agitation. And he said, Mildred, he said, he didn't even say good morning. He just said, Mildred, do you know what's in this book? What would you answer? I didn't know what he was referring to. And he said again with more agitation, do you know what's in this book? And I went into a hot sweat, and it was not menopause. I thought, my God, I must have left my fourth step in there. It was not my fourth step that had excited him. He went on to tell me, this stern military person that I had feared, with the tears rolling down his cheeks, went on to tell me that he had had an uncle who died of alcoholism. He said, I'm a preacher, and my daddy was a preacher, and my granddaddy was a preacher, and he said we couldn't help him. He'd sit in the church in the front row, and I thought, isn't that just like an alcoholic? And he'd wet his pants. And he said he'd come to our family functions and he'd do all kinds of terrible things. And he said we tried everything that we knew. And he said I would never have believed that the answer is in this book. And that's what he wanted to tell me. And I was reminded that I ought every day to be grateful that I live in a time when I have had the opportunity to live this way, as we have laid down, as we've heard about all weekend. And I'm not having to die unless I choose to. I'm not having to die in a ditch. And for most of my life, I was sure that's what was going to happen to me. Well, how did I get here? I was born on a farm in Saskatchewan. I'm a girl, obviously. I was Roman Catholic. Am still German, and the youngest of 10 children. And on all those scores, I thought I was just in bad shape. I don't ever remember feeling whole. I don't ever remember feeling happy. You know, I sometimes hear people who say they had normal childhood. I guess I had a normal childhood on the outside. I wasn't beaten. I wasn't abused. I wasn't starved. I was treated very well, as a matter of fact, but inside it was never enough. When I was about 3 1/2, those are my first recollections of consciousness. It was a recollection of lying in bed and crying beside the person that I loved most in the world, my retarded sister. In those days, that's what they called them. They did not know about levels of intelligence and that people can be helped and they can learn at their own level and all that kind of thing. They kept her in grade 3 till she was 16. They called her Dumb Dora. She was overprotected, and she knew she was different, and she used to cry. And she would say, why didn't I die in the cradle, Mildred? Why was I ever born? And I would lie there because I'm a little kid. I don't know how, what from what. And I would cry with her, and I would say, why was I ever born? Why didn't I die in the cradle? Did that make me an alcoholic? Absolutely not. But what I believe it did, it set a pattern in place that I was to try to deal with myself all my life. I think, in a way, my sister Dora was God's gift to me. She was a frightened person for her reasons. I was a frightened person for mine. I can look at that now and say, intelligence had absolutely nothing to do with it. I had an abundance of intelligence, and I was just afraid. If ever a person has had a soulmate, I have had a soulmate in my sister Dora, because I believe we've been on exactly the same journey, even though she is not alcoholic. Because I don't believe this is really about not drinking. I think it's about something infinitely more special, infinitely more important than not drinking. Like Johnny said, you know, his mother would say, well, or somebody said, I haven't had a drink in 90 years, I guess it was. Well, the other thing that I think helped define the way my life went was my attitude to God. I can't remember people telling me that God was to be feared. Anyway, I don't think we hear what really is said. I think we hear from what's not in front of our eyes, but rather what's in our souls already, what's behind our eyes. What I heard the priest say was, God is love, and God is power. Whoa, now I've got an answer, because if God is love and God is power, I've got a solution for my sister. And I prayed, you bet I prayed. You know what happened? Zero. Everything stayed the same. Everything stayed the same. And I venture to say that most of my life, as I've prayed to have my will done, everything has stayed the same. You see, I don't think we're here to decide what it is that should happen and tell God how he ought to deal with his other kids and how things should go for them. You see, after I came into the program, actually at 20 and 21 years sober, when I read the third step, when it talks in there about sometimes self-willed people like me, we're deceived because we think because we're asking for good things, we're asking correctly. And we don't understand that we don't have a right to meddle in somebody else's life. That each of us is here, I believe, on a contract with our Creator to do the work that we came here to do in the manner and in the place that we're doing it. We don't have to go looking for God's will in Africa, you know, feeding the poor, or in India. It's right in front of me in the shoes that I'm standing. But I didn't understand that in those days. What I found out was that I didn't have any power. That's what I really found out. I had lots of questions about this God. I can't say that I was angry. I was just confused. If God loves us and if God is all powerful, why doesn't he fix Dora? Why doesn't he stop the crying? And then I tried my brothers. I have four big brothers, and Dora used to say, I go to the country dances and nobody dances with me. Says I, I'm going to fix that. And I went to my brothers, and they remember this very well. And I would say to them, you know, when you go on Friday night, you should dance with Dora. And then, like a good little Al-Anon person, I'd wake up, I'd stay up, and when the door would open, I'd be right there. And I'd say, did they dance with you? And she'd start to cry, and she'd say, no. And she would cry, and I would cry. And that's how I spent a lot of my childhood. On the outside, you see, what I did on the outside, I decided that you were all a bunch of that. Hard, cold people. You didn't understand the world. You didn't understand the world the way I did. I just thought nobody sees the world. You see, I started to think that I was unique, that I was different. And I decided I'm not going to expose myself to that. It's too painful trying to get people to fix the problems. I'm just going to hide behind my wall. Did I do that consciously? I don't think so, but that's effectively what I did. I built a wall, and I lived behind that wall for years. I lived behind that wall in Alcoholics Anonymous and wondered why I did not feel happy, joyous, and free. I went to a convent when I was 18 because I was still, you know, I felt lousy. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. I found alcohol when I was 5, and it was an instant love affair. And I don't think I thought sober again, ever, because alcohol was in, it was my solution. It was my friend. It was my comforter. It did everything that I wanted it to do, and it could do it in 10 minutes. I could close my eyes, take that booze, close my eyes, open them maybe 5-10 minutes, and all the nasty people were gone. They might all look the same, but they weren't the same. They were nice, loving people, and I was a nice, loving person, and everything was just fine. I did not know about my grandfather. I did not know about my uncles. I didn't know that this substance could kill me, and that it would one day take me to Skid Row. I had no thought of that. It was my friend. And all the years that I drank, if people said to me, "You drink too much," I would think, "How is this possible? I can't drink enough. How can I drink too much?" You know, I was thirstier after the 50th drink than I was after the first one. And of course, the book says that, doesn't it? That once we get the booze into us, then the craving is set up, the allergy which manifests as a craving. I used to think that I started drinking because I was thirsty or that because I had this craving. I didn't understand. I got the craving because I put the booze in, and I put the booze in because of my mental condition. Not the ones the psychiatrist said, but the one the book said. The main problem of the alcoholic rests in his mind. See, I lack proportion and can't think straight, and that's on a good day, so you should see me operate on a bad one. At 18, I decided to go to a convent. You see, by this time, I was already well into alcoholism. You know, I'm not even going to touch the subject of when did I become one. I just knew from the first drink I had, I knew there was a solution, and I pursued it to the gates of death. And so, at 18, I thought, I'm going to go to a convent. See, what I didn't understand either was that I was a person filled with fear. I was a person who knew things didn't work out for her. I had proof. It had happened in childhood. Nobody listened to me then, and nobody would listen to me now. And so I ran from life. I ran to a place where one more time I was going to deal with God, and I was going to find a way to get God to do what I wanted God to do, which was to fix what was going on in here, which was so painful, which was to fix my sister. You know, and I wouldn't have even really known. I just knew that I didn't have the power. You know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I saw that part in the book where it says lack of power, I knew that all my life, that I couldn't make life to be. It didn't stop me from trying, but I certainly knew that I did not have the power to make my life to be the way I wanted it to be. I stayed in that convent for 15 years, and that's all I'll say, except to say that if you want to drink, my dears, you can drink in a monastery. You don't have to be outside. People sometimes are real fascinated. Like, how do you stay drunk in a convent? Easy. If you're a red-blooded alcoholic the way I am, you lie, you cheat, you steal, you do everything except take from Sunday collection. I kept my hands off that, I swear. You know, in those days we wore those long black clothes, and one day I came into the sacristy and my long black skirt swished over the collection plate. And the priest said, "My goodness, we have taking weight." And I thought, "Oh my God, he thinks I'm stealing." You see, while I was in there stealing mass wine and ordering extra mass wine and having my booze delivered to the bell tower of the church and trying to hide this from him, he also was alcoholic, trying to hide his stealing from me. He was not as fortunate as I was. He died of his disease. Anyway, in 1965, my father died, and I went home to his funeral. And I was drunk the whole time. And, walking out after the casket, my two big brothers beside me, and one of them looked at me and said, "You're drunk, sister." And, I guess I had a goofy smile on my face. You need a little lubrication to deal with the pain. Did you understand that, don't you? When I got back to Ontario, Mother Superior called me in, and she said, "Would you like to leave the convent?" And I said, "I don't know." I didn't know where I fit on the planet. I didn't fit at home. I didn't fit in church. Didn't fit in school. Didn't fit with my peers. Didn't fit with older people. I was always odd man out, and that's the way I felt. Didn't fit in the convent. And so when she said, "Would you like to leave?" I don't know. So we talked a bit, and I swear to you, in 15 years, even though they knew all my secrets, nobody ever said anything to me about drinking. Nobody ever said to me, "Do you take pills? Do you take booze? What is this business with, the stuff stored in the bell tower of the church?" Nobody, I think the denial was kind of deep. She said, "Are you happy here?" And I said, "No." "Well," she said, "you're young enough." She said, "We won't ask you to leave, but if you want to leave, we'll write to Rome," and that's what we did. And I remember standing on the convent steps January the 10th, 1966, and I thought my problems were over. You see, by this time I had had the opportunity, and I put that in quotation marks, to do a lot of studies. I had studied theology, and I had studied philosophy, and I had studied psychology, and I hadn't studied myself. I didn't know that the problem was within me. I figured, okay, I'll take off this habit. I'll no longer be Sister Mary Eugenia. I'll get my secular name back. I'll be dispensed from the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and I'm going to be fine. Wrong. I left, and in 10 months, I lost my innocence. That's all I'll say about that period, because you're bad. I said innocence. I didn't know this whole world existed out there, and again, I didn't fit. See, I thought it was as simple as you could leave one place and you could go to another. Our book says we have strange mental blank spots. It says we're strangely insane about the alcohol, but I have strange mental blank spots about life. I am strangely insane where the events of my days take place. I thought it was as simple as moving me physically out of a convent into another way of living, and I would be okay. Didn't know the problem was in here. And of course, as I said, the next 10 months were absolute hell. My brother found me locked up in an insane asylum in a true snake pit, and he asked me if I'd like to go back to the West. And he took me back to Saskatchewan, and it was there that I met the man who was to become my husband. See, it was going to be better when I got out of the convent. Then it was going to be better. I've always looked for something out there to fix what can only be fixed as an inner job by the grace of God. I think that's what I really have learned, because that man looked like the answer to the maiden's problem. He was going to fix me. I wasn't with him 20 minutes and I knew that this was wrong, but he had what I wanted. We say we get into relationships. Do we really? They're parasitic entanglements. See, I had something he wanted. I was 18 years his junior, and he was a psychiatrist, and he was on staff at the university. And he had positions, he had money, he was going to take me where I couldn't get myself. Remember, I'm a little innocent. Oh, on the outside, I get degrees and I do stuff, and I look competent on the outside, but inside I'm crying in the dark. And so he's going to take me into the world I can't get into myself. Well, you know, I think Phil from California says it. Their neuroses were complementary. The rocks in his head fit the holes in hers, and they sure did. He was a wonderful psychiatrist, you know. He really was. His patients adored him. But like many other people, me included, I could do intellectual stuff, but when it came to my own life, I couldn't see the forest for the trees, and that's the way he was. We've had a terrible existence together. I'd like to tell you he was the problem. He wasn't. He was a sick alcoholic just like I was, but he did introduce me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went. I was in Prince Albert, and many of you know Cease, don't you? Cease was my first sponsor. I loved AA for 3 weeks. Just loved it. Hadn't a clue what was going on there. Hadn't a clue what was necessary to stay sober. 3 weeks went by and my emotions was totally out of whack. See, I think I stopped growing when I picked up the first drink. While my peers were doing the things that they needed to do to continue to grow and to challenge life and figure out how things work, I hid in a bottle the easy, soft way. And so I was about 5 years old mentally. And I had learned that there were pills that you could take. I didn't want to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I wanted to be here with sober people. But again, you see, I've always wanted life on my terms. And I have found out I get nothing on my terms. If I want to live here peacefully, it's got to be on God's terms. It's got to be on the terms that God has showed me through Alcoholics Anonymous, that God has showed me through people like yourself. It can never be on my terms. And so I sat in AA stoned. It just interferes a teensy-weensy bit with how you see things. Chuck Chamberlain used to come at that time, you know, and I used to think, if Chuck Chamberlain can't help you, you are doomed, lady. And he would say to me, Miss Mildred. And when he called you Miss Mildred and raised the finger, you knew he was not speaking as sweetly as he seemed to be. He would say, you already are everything that you can ever be. Oh, yeah? And he'd say, you already know everything that you can ever know. He said, I guess that doesn't impress you too much. And it didn't. I didn't know what he was talking about. I do today. And he didn't explain it either. He said, someday you will know. And so after 5.5 years of that phoniness, that kind of hypocrisy, sitting in meetings of alcoholics, oh, I want to say something else. If somebody tells you that all you have to do is don't drink and go to meetings, don't you believe them? And if they tell you don't drink and go to meetings and read the book, don't you believe them either? And if they tell you don't drink and go to meetings and read the big book and do 12-step work, don't you believe them either? Because there's a little problem, that a little situation that has not been included there. And that is the inner change that has to take place through doing these steps. You see, I did all that. They used to let me go out to the women's jail. I went faithfully. You know, now Cease tells everybody, he said, she carried the disease, not the message. But, you know, I went. And I'm glad that I had that experience, because when I came back this time, I knew exactly where the work was to be. And I found people who took me through that work. The brick had to come out of the bucket, you know. I had to do some changing, and all in due time. I drank for another year and a half, you know, into DTs, convulsions. I would never have believed, when I came here in 1966, I used to say, that's as low as I'm going to go. Oh, yeah? I didn't know what low was. When I came here in 1973, I had slept 3 nights on a park bench, and after I did get through a treatment center, I went down to Skid Row, and I lived there for 9 months, and there were days we didn't have food because we had no money. See, my husband was an alcoholic, too, and anyway, I'm getting a little ahead of myself. I drank for another year and a half, and I think I have qualified myself, as Tom said, how much we drink, where we drink, and all that, with whom we drink that stuff. That's not the essence of it. The drama of my life is not the essence of my alcoholism. You see, if you put booze into me, I can't guarantee my behavior, because the allergy that manifests as a craving, and the insane part of this, the insane part, but I think it's God's teaching tool, is that I do this thing repeatedly, that I say, this time it will be different. I'm going to manage to get my own ease and comfort. As it says in the book, you know, we took alcohol because it gave us ease and comfort. And, you know, I can remember the days when I would set, I had no money other than the money I had spent on a 26-ounce of vodka. And I could sit there knowing that tomorrow I might be on the street, but if I had that 26 of vodka, right then I didn't care about anything else. If I ever serve God and the program as diligently and as trustfully as I serve booze, I'll just be fine forever. On the morning of May the 28th, what am I saying, 28th? The day of May the 18th, I wound up in a psych ward. And I remember well opening my eyes, and there were two men sitting at the foot of my bed, and they really were there. I couldn't really move the next day. And Sunday morning, the nurse took me out of bed. She took me to the washroom, and she was going to get me walking. And we went into the washroom, and I saw myself. I weighed about 85 pounds. My eye was sticking out like this, and I had a rim of purple around my face. My hair was straggly, and I had teeth knocked out. I may not be a raving beauty now, but I can tell you I certainly was not that morning. And I started to cry, and I said to her, I've really become a woman of the streets, haven't I? Now, to somebody who had been raised in the respectable German home, with Roman Catholic parents going to church every day, who knew all the neighbors, who, you know, and then somebody who had spent 15 years in a convent, this is really not the way you plan to live your life. And I said, and she said, yes, you have become a woman of the streets. And she took me to breakfast. And while I sat there at breakfast, I made up my mind I was going to take my life. How little we know about what's really going on. You know, we say here, hang in until you get the miracle. How important that is. See, I have come to believe now that God does not let some of us get sober and not others. That is not a God. That is a monstrosity. See, I think the gift of life is always given to us. I can say yes to the gift of life today and nourish my life, or I can take my life. I can say yes to the gift of sobriety, or I can say no. And for many years, I said no. I want it my way. I will get my ease and comfort the way I have determined. And I didn't know all that. You know, I think often when we're living our lives, we don't understand. I haven't understood what was happening. It's only as I've been here and I've heard speakers like Tom and Arbutus and Johnny and people like yourself that I have had the opportunity to reflect and understand. And what I believe that morning, God knew that I was ready to say yes, because I went back to the room and I said to the nurse, I'm signing myself out, which I was allowed to do, and I was going to take my life. And as I was sitting there on the bed, waiting for her to bring the paper, I had an experience of the presence of God. I didn't used to want to talk about that, because I'd think, what are they going to think of me? I don't know what you think of me. That's what happened. And I said yes. I didn't know what I was saying yes to. I just knew that the compulsion to drink was gone. And I swear to you, in 24 years and 10 months and some days, the compulsion to drink has never, it's gone. It's gone. But I also believe that I don't get a free ride here. It was taken because I was ready to give it. I had tried my best to have my way, and it didn't work. And that day, God knew that I was ready to say yes, and I said yes. And, you know, I remember sitting there thinking, oh, my God, I'll never have any fun again. As if my life had been such a riot. And I remember saying to God, or to whatever there was, I didn't know what was going on. I just said, I will be sober, I will cooperate, but I don't know how to live. See, I knew that. I knew. My mother used to cry, and she would say, Mildred, you're such a nice girl when you don't drink. Why do you drink so much? Yeah. I mean, I'd like to be a nice girl, as you call a nice girl, but I can't stand being a nice girl, as you define a nice girl. So how do you do this? And I said, you'll have to send somebody to me to tell me how. And I swear there was a rap on the door, and a man stood there. And he said, I saw you at breakfast. See, I think what we have to keep in mind is that God appears in many faces. God appears through the soul that talks to us. God appears through people, whatever. Many times we just don't recognize the face of God. I asked, and there he was. And he said, I saw you at breakfast. Are you an alcoholic? And I said, yes. You want to make something of it? I mean, why get good too fast? He said, no, I just thought maybe I could be of assistance. You want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous? Get away from me. I don't ever want to see those people again. I went there for 5.5 years. They couldn't help me. He said, would you go to a treatment center? I said, what? And he told me, Donwood. And I went through my file of places that I had been, and I thought, I don't think I've been there. So I said, okay. And that's what happened. It took me a few days to get in there. I had no support system. You see, by the time I got here, everybody had walked away from me. You know, and I could think that morning there was not a person on the planet that would have opened the door to me had I come. That was because of the way I drank, but it was also because of the way I lived. You know, the indecent, improper, terrible things that I did. And so I went through this place called Donwood and not come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got this down now. You see, they taught me some nutrition, and they taught me about a little relaxation therapy and all the stuff that they did in those days. And then people started to appear. I always say the three P's showed up. One was poverty. We had no money. My psychiatrist, he was as sick as I was. He was sitting there saying, I'm depressed, and he really genuinely was, I guess. And so my psychiatrist at the institution said, Mildred, I'm sick of you. He said, I'm sick of you whining. If you want to kill yourself, go ahead. But he said, if you want to get well, here's my phone number. You can get me 24 hours a day. You know, how did that happen? Think about how these kinds of things happen. And then there was poverty. I didn't know what poverty was. You know, we take a vow of poverty and everybody else lives it seems to me. And there were days we didn't have food. He said, go get a job. I certainly was not in a position where I could take on a teaching job. I thought I'd never teach again because they threw me out and told me to be gone and never on the property again. I thought that was a pretty definitive way of going. And, you know, there were times we didn't have enough to eat. And I'm grateful for those days. I can remember standing. Eventually, I got a job as a clerk in a store. And I remember standing there with 40 cents in my hand saying, should I go get a cup of coffee and a lemon tart, or should I take this home and add it to the grocery money so we can have a meal? That's how poor we were. And I'm grateful for it because, you know, some of us need not humiliation. We need ego deflation in depth. And I'll tell you, poverty like that strips it from you. There was no big car. There were no fancy clothes. There was nothing to say, here, world, here I am, phony as that might be. I was where I needed to be, on Skid Row. And I remember thinking, you put yourself here. You're going to get yourself up. You did this. Nobody did this to you. And then the program, 6 months into this kind of living, and I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, not because I thought you had anything, not to find God, not even to find sobriety. See, take alcohol out of any one of us. And if you don't put something else in, what have you got? A crazy person. I was quite crazy by this time. And I walked into a meeting, and the miracle started to happen. Not the miracle of, here, come do this. The miracle of feeling that I had a place to go. I can't describe it any more than that. I was so broken, I just came in here and sat down, and people said, keep coming back, and I kept coming back, and I started to love coming here. And I was coming here 5 and 6 days a week. And then I made another discovery. It wasn't enough, you know. I was waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I had the same kind of fear, and I had the same kind of despair, and I didn't know what to do. My first sponsor had gotten drunk, and two guys in my group said, you should do the steps, and I said, I don't know how. That was really something for me to say, I don't know how, I can't figure it out. And you know what? There were no big book studies in those days. Those two men took me, they'd take me into the corner, and they'd say, read this, and do this. And they took me through the steps. And, you know, it was probably the simplest way of doing the steps. But you know what? We're not rewarded for smarts here. We're not rewarded because we can analyze and think our way through, and because we can write lofty dissertations about the steps or whatever the hell we think we might want to do with those steps. I just did what I was told. And guess what? It worked. It worked. I changed. Something happened in here. I remember doing my fourth step, and before I went to read it to the priest, I read it to myself, and all of a sudden, the light went on. I thought, this is it. He told me, my sponsor, the men had told me to do the four columns, and I did. My part, let go of what the others did. Look at your part. And I thought, I finally know what's wrong with me. I've spent years blaming the church, Mother Superior, the sisters, my dad, my mother, my brothers and sisters, anybody that crossed my path. You were to blame for the way I was. And there it was right in front of me. Mildred, you are the problem. Wow. What a piece of information that was. And I understood what Moose used to say at meetings. He'd say, it's not important what you think of me. It's important what I think of you. And I'd follow him and I'd say, Moose, what do you mean? He'd say, the enemy is always within. If you have hatred and criticism, and if you're unloving inside, he said, life can't go well. That's what you have to work on, cooperating with that change. And there was another man who's dead now, Ted Lynch. And he used to say, Mildred, do the do thing. I don't know how many times that saved my bacon, because I was such an emotional child. I, you know, one minute I might feel up, the next minute I might feel down, and I used to hear his voice drilling in my ear, do the do thing. And I'll tell you, many a time it kept me walking the streets of Toronto to get the next job, to do the next thing I had to do, whether I felt like it or not. And then came my 1 year of sobriety. And the day after my 1 year of sobriety, the voice said, look in the paper. Maybe you should teach again. And I said, it's impossible. See, I look at my life now, and I can see that everything I brought into my life through self-will, through my direction, through my determination, I've lost every single thing. It was there for a while, and then it went bye-bye. And everything that has come through this miraculous gift of grace It all meant something important in the way my life is today. I saw a job advertised. Little did I know that I would be teaching adolescents who were emotionally disturbed and who had learning disabilities. And for 20 years, I got to do for them what nobody had done for my sister because they didn't know how. And I felt... because when I saw the job ad, all I read was English teacher. I didn't read who it was for. And I got the job, and I thought, well, you know, by this time I'm stretching my AA muscles. I've done the steps. I know, boy, I've got this program. I'm going to march into that school and teach them what this is all about. You know what? They taught me what it was all about because I was still a child. And, you know, I'd go into that school, and sometimes I'd be okay, and the next day I'd go in, and the kids would say, stay away from her. She's in a bad mood. God, I hated that. Mrs. A.A. in a bad mood just doesn't fit, does it? You know, I think of all the wonderful people who crossed my path, and some of them were teachers in that school who've never had a drink too much, who saw how much trouble I was in, who took me aside and taught me how to live, who taught me how to deal with my emotions, who taught me how to speak up, who taught me when to be silent, who helped me develop into a mature human being. Some of those people were in Alcoholics Anonymous, and some of them weren't, and I'm grateful for every single one of them. About a year and a half into sobriety, I left my husband. My sponsor said, give yourself a rest. Do you listen? No. 3 weeks later, I've got a man in my life. He, too, is perfect. He's going to take me into the good life. Poor fella can't stay. I didn't know that. He calls me 3 weeks into this wonderful relationship and says, I can't stay sober. I'm drinking. What? Well, thought I, he's perfect for me. I will. He's never had me in his life. Good. 2.5 years later, after, you know, I'm sure I worried him more than, you know, followed him, tried to keep him sober. He had the key to the good life. Friends, I'm telling you, there's nobody out there can give you the key to the good life. Go find it yourself through the grace of God. See, I thought... I found myself 4 years sober. I'm standing over him. He's on the bed. I've got his ears in my hands. He's hung over. I'm sober. He says, I want beer. Go get me beer. I said, no, you're going to pray. Because I don't want to pray. I want beer. So I pounded his head on the bed, and I said, you pray, you son of a bitch. And then I went to Al-Anon. I did. Wow. 7 years into sobriety, I had paid off my debt. I had paid off my husband's debts, and I had paid off the debts we had accumulated together. Fellas, you should have known me then. And I had no money. I had my old rusty car, and I had the furniture that I had rented. I had literally nothing at 7 years. By this time, I was 12-stepping like your theme is, the wonderful 12-step work. I think perhaps I was still kind of carrying the disease rather than the message. All those sponsees that had come to me, most of them went out and got drunk, but you know what? I did the best I knew how to do, and you know who stayed sober? I know I'm never responsible for whether you stay sober. All I am responsible for is to do the best I know how in my dealings with you. And so my sponsor said, we need to do the steps again. And we did the steps again. And that for me was a turning point because my rage came out. I was raised in a family where you did not talk back. And then I always found myself in positions. You don't talk back to Mother Superior either. You don't talk back to the Pope. And you don't talk back to your psychiatrist's husband. I had no experience of letting my feelings out. And we did the steps, and I found out how much rage was within. And it all came out. And I find that every time I change inside, the outside changes. And I'm going to tell you what the next period was. You know, I started buying houses. The income tax laws in Canada were very favorable to that kind of stuff at that time. And only by the grace of God. You know, I think if we could only see that the angel of grace stands at our shoulder all the time and that everything is necessary. You know, every single thing. I became very rich. And, you know, I'm saying that to you because it was part of my growth. There was another thing I had to learn, and that is that riches can't heal the holes in your soul. You can surround yourself with the best the world has to offer and still be crying on the inside. I remember six-figure checks coming in, and I remember buying my own house, and I remember all the stuff, the new for. Remember, I'm the one with the old rusty car, and the new red convertible standing on the driveway, and the new stuff that was coming in, and the new furniture. And I was in a period of depression. You know what that stuff did for me? Zero. It didn't do anything to me. And I thought, my God, this isn't it either. And I think God in his wisdom let me see that because I had a ways to go yet. And that went on for a while, and I'm busy in AA, and I have a sponsor, and I'm sponsoring, and I'm speaking, and I'm doing service in my group. And you know what? If you had said to me, are you happy? Has it come true, that thing that says God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free? I would have had to say, well, yeah, pretty good. But somewhere in here, it still hurts. It still hurts. And by this time, another man had come into my life, and God, he too was going to be my answer to the good life. It's amazing how these things all let you down. You know, you meet these people, you think you're in love, and you find out you were in heat all along. And one day you wake up, and you find out the real work should begin. The real work of really working on a relationship. And that's when, one more time, I went into my old ways. I didn't know how to be in a relationship and tell the truth. And over a period of 15 years, we built, well, a relationship that had died a long time ago. And I guess I was 18 years sober. I was in the South, and two people were there talking about doing the steps. And I thought, I know, I've done that. If you want to stay where you are, assume you know everything. I got back to Toronto, and it was just like a record in my head. Do the steps, do the steps, do the steps. And finally I said, stop it! I went to my sponsor and I said, help me, help me through the steps again, and he did. And one more time, something released in here, and I knew that I had to say goodbye to the 15-year relationship, because it was no longer, it was not, never had been, and it was the best I knew how to do, but I didn't know how to have an honest relationship. And so I said goodbye to the man. And then the voice said, give up your job. What? I don't have children. And I did. I wrote my resignation. And I have to tell you, that's when the exciting period of my life began. And I'd like to share a few things about that with you. I'm 20 years sober at this time. And, you know, people look up to me. I have sponsees. As I said, I'm busy and I'm doing the best I know how to do. And I'm dying inside. Absolutely dying inside. All those things that I felt when I was a little girl came full circle. You're nothing. You're nobody. You're not even going to leave children and grandchildren. What have you lived for? You know, and I couldn't answer it. Couldn't answer it. And, but I did know this. I kept coming here. I came to meetings sometimes when I just felt I was dying inside. And I'd just take a seat and I'd just sit there. I felt as if I was breaking apart inside. But I came here because you are my folks. You are my family. You have been my healing. And one thing at a time happens. And one day I lay there in bed and I determined to take my own life. You know, that shouldn't happen at 20 years, but I'm going to tell you the truth. What's the point of getting up here and telling you something that didn't happen to me? That is precisely what happened. You see, the book says that self is the problem. And I think that self gets stripped from us and our feet get put to the fire. And you know, mine got put to the fire and I'd pull back, and to the fire and I'd pull back. And the process, if you want to purify metal, you put it into the fire. And I had to go all the way into the fire, as many of you have, I'm sure. But that day, I didn't know that. I just knew that I couldn't handle my life anymore the way it was. I had done my very best. I was out of answers. And I lay there, and that night, about 6 o'clock, put my hand out of the bed. And there I picked up a scribbler, a notebook, and I just opened it at random. And there I had written at an earlier time, "Mildred, do you know how to make the pain go away?" And I had written, "Absolutely not." "Mildred, do you know how to take your life out of the toilet?" And I had written, "Absolutely not." And one more time. That for me was the surrender. That for me was the ability to say, "What have you been fighting for all these years? Why have you been trying to get your plan, which was you get lots of money, you get lots of fame, you get lots of fortune, you get people to..." I don't even know what my plan was. It was just, none of it had worked. And that day I let it go. And one more time, I experienced the presence of God, and I got out of that bed, and I knew that I was going to be okay. Because one more time, I knew that there was an unconditionally loving God who was active in my life and had been with every breath that I had ever taken, and that every piece of this puzzle fit. Did it all get better all at once? No, but the phone started to ring. And my friend, the Jesuit Father O'Brien, was on the end. He said, "Would you like to give retreat?" I said, "I don't think so. I'm excommunicated about 15 times, I think." He said, "I don't care about that." He said, "We have retreats for men and women out here." So another whole life opened up to me. I give retreats. Imagine me and 75 men. Heaven on earth, I'm telling you. Tell them I'm taking resumes, and once in a while they send me one. People started to come and ask me to do big book studies with them, to take them through the steps. They asked me to hear 5th steps. I'm involved with the Retired Teachers Association. They elected me president of that organization. And I, for a while, worked at the cancer hospital. So my life filled up. It filled up, and I got to understand what was going on. I got to look at step one, because when you're trying to help somebody else understand it, you have to understand it yourself. And what I found was the richness of those steps, the richness of what we have here. Step one, sure, I'm powerless over alcohol, but that's no big news. I'm powerless over life. As Arbutus said, "I can't manage my life. I'm a guest here." You know, I think Job had the same kind of problem when he was complaining to God and said, "Why did you take this stuff from me?" And God said, "Where were you, smartass, when I hung the stars in the heavens? And when I put the tops on the mountains, and when I put the depths in the sea? Like, who would I think I am that I should know how everything should work, who you should be, how Dora's life should be, how even my own life should be?" See, when I came here, if you had said, "Here's a bag with $1 million in it, and here's the book with the 12 steps in it, and the 12 traditions, and the legacy of service, which will you have?" Huh? Case closed. My head would have said something like this: "I'll take the $1 million, and when I get my life the way I want it, then God, I'll deal with you." And God said, "You're going to go my way," because nothing fell into place at that time. And I went the way of the 12 steps as I could do it at 1 year. And I went the way of the 12 steps as I could do it at 7 and at 18. And I went the way that I had to go. I think the face of God looks quite different than I thought it was going to look, you know. So I found out that I'm a guest here. You know, and if I'm a guest, then I think you are too. It has made life so easy. Why would I think then? If I'm a guest, I don't bully my way around. I haven't complained to the committee. They've been wonderful. But I didn't call and say I don't like my room and I don't like what you've provided. I know how to behave as a guest. I haven't been a very good guest on the planet. I'm a much better guest now. And then step two, which tells me there's a power bigger than me. You know what? On page 24, it says I've lost the power of choice in drink. If I've lost the power of choice, then tell me, how have I managed to stay sober one moment at a time for all these years? How have you? If you have lost the power, we should be ragingly drunk, dead, in prison, jail, wherever, eh? We're not. We're here clean and sober, mostly in our right minds. You know, I think that is what step two means. I can look and say, has God proved to me that he is unconditionally loving? You know, if I can look at my life and where I should be and say there's not an unconditionally loving God, I'm still insane. I'm still insane if I don't see the power of God. You know, Longfellow said it years ago. He said, I do not see the wind at all or hold it in my hand, and yet I know the wind is there because it swirls the sand. And God is very much like this, invisible as air, and yet we know and see his goodness everywhere. And you know, I think of that, how that truth, people have known that. We don't see God the way we thought we were going to see God. But all the great things we don't see anyway, because they are an experience. Where do you see 2 + 2 = 4? You ever seen that? The principle of 2 + 2 = 4, it's invisible as air. What about gravity? Have you ever seen gravity, or do you see it by its effect? I never fight with gravity, do you? I never fight with the principle 2 + 2 = 4 either and say, well, I don't like that today. I'm going to write 2 + 2 = 4.5 and see what happens. And yet I live my life all the time like that. And if I believe that this power is in the process of restoring me to its order, which I think is what sanity really is, God knows what's best. I've been denied things I wanted, and I can look now and say, that was the unconditional love of God that kept me from that. And I got this, and that taught me a lesson, and everything is perfect. If we could just see that the angel of perfection stands by us all the time, and nothing is wasted. Clancy was in Toronto 6 weeks ago, and somebody asked him, what would you change in your life if you could? And Clancy said, not a thing. He said, because every single thing has been necessary for me to stand where I'm standing today. Now, I'm almost done. I have one more thing to tell you. I was changing and changing and changing, and I realized something. I had put up the walls when I was a little girl. That's why I didn't feel connected to anybody. And I realized that who's going to take down those walls? I had to take them down, and I had to start getting rid of the masks, and I had to get real. People used to say to me, you used to intimidate me. I know what intimidated them. They came up against, smack up against the wall. You will come this far and no further, and then I won't let you in, and you don't build connections. So I was sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, it was good. But I didn't really feel that connection that I do today. I feel connected to you today. I had to start telling the truth. I had to start saying to people, this is the truth. This is who you've been dealing with. I would like to be friends with you. Could we have coffee together? Could we do this? And my life has changed. My home has become kind of, I've got a family now. You know who they are. They're you. They're the people that come in and they want this and they want that, and will you hear my fifth step? Because the walls have come down to a good extent. There was something still missing. I still in the morning would feel like that little girl. You know, fearful, fearful. Our book tells me why we have fear. It's because self-reliance fails. And I still had my plan kind of in operation. I didn't know that. When you're ready, trust me, the teacher will appear. One night I went to a meeting. I almost didn't go to this meeting. And I have been saying to the people that I was working with, I don't know what this is, but I sort of wake up with a low-grade depression in the morning, and I don't know what this is about. That night I went to this meeting, and nobody else at that meeting remembers this man. He was there for me. He told this story about how he had this terrible rage. And he said he came into Alcoholics Anonymous, he believed in nothing. But his sponsor had said, you get on your knees every morning and you ask this nothing to keep you sober that day. And at night you get on your knees and you say thank you. And he said he had his 1 year, and he said as he was having his 1 year celebration, he said he realized that everybody he knew was doing so much better than he was. And he said he couldn't stop his rage. He would yell at his kids. He would yell at his wife. Sometimes, you know, he said even in business he was dreadful. So he said that morning when he was on his knees, he said, and please help me with my rage. And he said he forgot that he'd said it, and that night when he got on his knees to say thank you, he said he realized he had not been rageful that day. And I heard the bulb went on for me. You smart little girl, you've been trying to fix your own life. You have thought that you could make your plans and that you were responsible for analyzing and figuring it out. And you know what? I decided the next morning that when I woke up, I would be on my knees, which is what I should have been doing all these years anyway. I used to do it when it suited me. And you know what? I'm here to tell you that was over a year ago. And I have not experienced a depression since then. And I have experienced an ease that I can only say has to be the grace of God, because I'm willing now to go God's way every day. And I understand that my intellect can fix zilch. Fabulous. That's what I came here to tell you.